Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. In the 1800s, people charged with crimes were locked up in large holding tanks. Men, women, kids, murderers or petty thieves, everybody was together in one place.
They were violent, they were disease-ridden, they were awful, awful places.
A group of Philadelphia advocates kept pushing for reform, a more humane way to confine prisoners.
They believed that people are good. They were influenced by the Quaker belief in an inner light, a sense of right and wrong that they believe all people carry. And so this building was an attempt to bring out the best character in every person.
This building is Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia. It opened its doors in 1829. I'm walking around with Sean Kelly. He's in charge of exhibits and tours here.
One of the things I think is most interesting about parts of the building like this.
The prison has long been closed. It's a museum now. We're in cell block two. There's a long hallway with a vaulted ceiling and skylights, small crumbling cells on both sides. You can see old iron beds in some. Each cell at Eastern State had a toilet at a time when indoor plumbing was mostly unheard of.
So this was supposed to be the good place.
It was supposed to be the good place. It's up for debate whether it was.
The idea was to give inmates a space to reflect on their lives, their choices, in solitude.
So they would take people who'd been convicted of crimes and put them in solitary confinement with the belief they would spend that time looking into their hearts and they would become penitent. This is the world's first true penitentiary. But their strategy was total isolation for the entire length of the sentence.
Every single prisoner was isolated in a small cell all day long.
And then for half an hour each morning and a half an hour each afternoon, they would open that door in the back of the cell and the folks could go outside into their own personal exercise yard.
No contact or conversation with other inmates. They couldn't even see each other. No visitors, no newspapers, nothing.
They fetishized silence in this building to the point where the officers literally wore socks over their shoes so their footsteps wouldn't ring in these hallways as we walked down the hallways.
The prison had about 1,000 cells, and staff brought food to each inmate on carts, and even that happened without a sound.
They rolled these carts down the corridors we're standing in, and they covered the wheels of the carts with leather so they would roll silently down the corridors.
And the inmates, they pushed back against the silence, against the isolation, the loneliness.
It's an unnatural way to live, and people rejected just their, there's this need that all of us have to communicate with other people and to be heard.
Inmates went to great lengths to connect with each other, to make contact with someone.
Like literally putting your face into a toilet bowl and yelling down directly into the sewer so your voice could be heard in cells nearby. That's what people were driven to here from this need to communicate.
The prison wardens kept logbooks, and their entries speak to that desperation.
January 27, 1835, discovered that six prisoners had been talking through holes made alongside of their hot water pipes.
May 14th, 1837. Early this morning, inmate 629, in attempting to talk from the top of his room, fell and broke his leg above the ankle.
Punishments for trying to communicate were draconian. Prisoners were beaten, doused with cold water in the winter, confined in total darkness, tied to chairs, gagged. Some died.
June 27, 1833. Number 102, having on several occasions got the men next to him talking, and being detected in the act. Last evening, I ordered the straitjacket and the gag. This I saw put on about 8 o'clock. About 9 o'clock, I was informed that they had found him in a lifeless state. I immediately went to him and found him warm, but with no pulse. We tried to bleed him and use ammonia and many other things, but life was extinct.
Despite the risks, from the time the prison opened to the time its solitary model was abandoned in 1913, inmates never stopped trying to make their voices heard, to break out of their isolation.
People hate it. They can't stand it.
Humans are social animals. We are hardwired for connection. We need social interaction, much like we need food and water to survive. On today's episode, we look into isolation and loneliness and how they impact our mental and physical health. All right, we're going to stay with this issue of isolation in prisons for a while, because prisons today still use solitary confinement. About 80,000 inmates in the U.S. are held in solitary. Claire Schoen talked to 9 former prisoners about that experience. What we're about to hear is an excerpt from a documentary she created with the American Friends Service Committee.
The hole.
We called it the hole.
The bucket, the cane,
the box, the bin,
the chiller,
lockup,
maxi,
the shoe,
solitary confinement.
Solitary confinement. One person, one cell.
The cell that I lived in most of the time was 6 feet wide and about 9 feet long.
The cell was probably like maybe 7 feet, maybe 9 feet long.
Maybe 9 by 6.
5 by 9.
The cell was a windowless cell.
The walls were cinder block.
Cement.
The bed is concrete. There's a small concrete slab that serves as your table.
And the floor, it was concrete.
There was a sink with no stopper and a toilet.
Everything is concrete and steel.
Metal and cement.
That was it.
Solitary confinement is not a punishment handed down by a judge or a jury. It's made by the warden or a prison board at their discretion once a convict is inside.
There was a big door that closed, and you didn't hear anything outside of the door.
And the first night that I was there, I thought, it's so quiet. But very quickly, the quiet becomes oppressive.
Mostly what you're going to hear is your own breathing, you know? You might hear your heart rate pumping up.
You could hear bugs.
What you hear is nothing. You know, there is no sound to hear.
Solitary can create sensory deprivation.
You had nothing in the room but you.
Just your lonely body in a cell that's empty.
It's hard to describe nothing.
Emptiness. That's what solitary confinement is.
At the same time, it can overwhelm the senses.
Coming onto the tier, it's a heavy steel door, and it opens electrically, which means you hear. They step in, and they just let it slam shut. All right? They walk down the tier, they get combat boots on.
Boots hitting concrete. And all the guards carry clubs.
Banging the batons or whatever it is they have, the nightsticks, against the wall.
You hear a lot of banging. Mental ill guys do this banging.
Screaming and yelling, crying, cops threatening, constant threats.
A crying baby. Or the leaves of a tree fluttering in the wind. You don't hear any of these sounds at all.
And you were confined to a cell 23 hours a day?
23 hours in lockup. I was there 24 hours a day.
I've spent 7.5 years in the control unit.
Maybe about 12 years in lockdown.
I was there for 29 years, you know, 29 years, you know, 29 years, 29 years.
It happens in Kentucky, Louisiana, California, New York. Every state in America uses solitary confinement.
Solitary confinement is just as real could be. It plays on you big time, and it could warp the mind.
What does it do to a person to be locked up in a 9 by 6 room? For weeks, months, years, alone.
A life like that, it damages you psychologically, you know, because human beings need to interact with each other.
I could hardly sleep, like I had insomnia.
Waking up at night, in the sweats, panic attacks.
I lost track of time.
There's no concept of time. You know no time in lockdown. There's sleep and awakeness. That's it. And the madness in between.
And the madness in between.
I distrusted a lot of my own perceptions.
Begin to hear voices, begin to see things.
You see sort of like something moved in your cell, that like there was somebody there.
And you never knew what it was.
And there's nobody there, you know?
I would try to hear things, try to hear human voices. And sometimes I would imagine that I was hearing noises.
You hear noise, and it sounds like somebody said something there.
You start hearing things that's not even being said.
And say, yeah, you know, yeah, what? And nobody's answering you.
And you wonder, what are they whispering about doing something to you? What are they even saying you going crazy? Paranoia sets in so deep, it just begins to collapse in on you.
And what happens is chaos.
Insanity. 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 Insanity.
That story was produced by Claire Schoen. To hear more of her work, check out her latest podcast, Stepping Up. We heard the voices of Hakeem Shahid, Laura Whitehorn, Robert DeLallo, Bilal Sunin Ali, Munira El Boumani, Ray Luke Levasseur, Tommy Escarziga, Diano King Archangel Rodriguez, and Robert King Wilkerson. For years, advocates have argued that solitary confinement should be completely banned in the U.S. They say it constitutes cruel and unusual punishment, as described in the Eighth Amendment. So far, federal courts have not been on their side. They've acknowledged that solitary confinement can cause psychological harm, but they've essentially said it doesn't rise to the level of cruel and unusual punishment. But new research on the neurological effects of isolation could tip the balance. Liz Tung has more.
It's a Sunday afternoon, and thousands of neuroscientists are mulling around the San Diego Convention Center. It's day three at the Society for Neuroscience's annual conference, and competition for crowds is fierce. But on this Sunday, one event has clearly grabbed the spotlight, a roundtable called Solitary Confinement, Psychological and Neurobiological Insights into Isolation.
So I'm very happy to see you here. There, isolation is a critical issue in the United States. It's largely invisible.
That's Michael Zygmunt. He's retired now, but spent decades as a neurology researcher and professor at the University of Pittsburgh.
It was actually an amazing experience for us. The room only held 250 people, and people were lined up outside waiting to get in.
It was an improbable turnout for what's kind of been an improbable project. Michael spent most of his multi-decade career studying neurodegeneration caused by Parkinson's. But about 4 years ago, he switched to a new mission, investigating extreme isolation and its effects on the brain, specifically mouse brains, which Michael says a lot of people, especially potential funders, do not seem to get.
I've essentially been told, we're not interested. What you're doing is totally irrelevant to the conditions of solitary confinement. You're studying laboratory animals. We're talking about humans. There's no connection.
Experiments involving mice are often a first step in research. But of course, in this case, there probably will never be human subjects to be experimented on. Most people would never consent to being locked up for years on end so that we could study their brains. Also, this wasn't the kind of research where you could just use brain scans. The experiment required something a little more gruesome.
We're required to take the brains out, and few humans want to donate their brains while they're living.
That's Michael's research partner, Richard Smaney. He's a neuroscientist at Jefferson University in Philadelphia. The two men have known each other for a while, but for Richard, this was not exactly an easy sell.
I had no interest in this.
Michael was persistent. He showed Richard all the research about what the most extreme version of isolation, solitary confinement, does to people psychologically.
I often say that Michael Zygmunt is my social conscience, and his passion really brought me into this, and now we're spending a lot of time doing this.
Since then, it's become something of a passion project for Michael and Richard. They've kept it afloat by working in their spare time and enlisting graduate students for help. Now, 4 years later, they're unveiling the fruits of their labors at the biggest neuroscience conference in the world. And not only that, they're sharing their data with everyone before they've had a chance to publish, which Richard calls
really unusual. You generally don't discuss your results with others ahead of time.
That's partly because researchers want to be completely sure about their findings. But it's also because they don't want some other scientist to swipe their findings before they've had a chance to publish. But in this case, Richard and Michael had decided to make an exception, because even though their work is far from done, what they have found seems urgent.
80,000 people today are sitting in solitary confinement. And if our findings suggest that we are causing a physical problem, I find it sort of really morally repugnant to hold that information, which could be used to alter something negative that we're doing to people.
Because Michael and Richard say that information could help answer the question of whether or not solitary confinement causes irreversible physical damage to the brain. If the answer is yes, it could be the key to changing the court's opinion on solitary confinement, the final puzzle piece that shows it is, in fact, cruel and unusual punishment. Now, I promise we will get to those findings, but first, let's rewind a bit and take a look at what exactly convinced these two neuroscientists, already decades into their careers, to change their professional trajectories in favor of research that you might even call activism. It all started about 7 years ago at a California prison called Pelican Bay.
About 100 demonstrators gathered to show support for inmates at Pelican Bay State Prison. The prison hunger strike is to protest conditions
in the state's employment of a long-term solitary confinement policy.
End torture now!
It was the state's first supermax, which means it used solitary confinement not as a temporary punishment, but basically as their main method of incarceration. For some inmates, that meant years, even decades in solitary. In 2012, one of those inmates, a guy named Todd Ashker, decided to file a lawsuit. So he wrote a letter to the Center for Constitutional Rights, a nonprofit that fights for social change through the courts. His letter arrived on the desk of the group's president, University of Pittsburgh law professor Jules Lobel.
The key thing it said is that we're here on hunger strike and we could really use a lawyer to turn this into a class action.
Solitary confinement was an issue that Jules had been working on for years.
And my view then and now is to put people in this situation for any substantial period of time is cruel punishment. It's just, you know, it's a basic assault on human dignity and on the human person.
But that's not how the court saw it. For them, damage has to be physical to be considered cruel and unusual, which gave Jules and his clients an idea.
Why don't we try to approach this from a neuroscience perspective? Namely, what's the effect of this on a physical organ, namely the brain?
So Jules enlisted a group of neuroscientists as expert witnesses who could testify to the fact that social connection isn't just something we enjoy, it's a basic human need, and depriving people of it can do physical harm. It was the first time this kind of argument had ever been made in a solitary confinement case, and it seems to have had an impact. Shortly after sending the briefs to Pelican Bay's lawyers, Jules got word. They were ready to settle.
Well, a big step toward ending long-term solitary confinement in California's prisons. The state has agreed to end the practice as part of
It was a major victory in the legal fight against solitary confinement, but it was also important in another way. It connected like-minded neuroscientists, and it sparked a kind of activist movement among them to use their research as a weapon against solitary confinement. One of those neuroscientists was Michael Zygmund. So Michael roped in his buddy Richard Smaney, and the two of them launched on this ambitious mouse research project we've been hearing about. Their goal was simple: to document the effects of isolation on the brain in a way that mimics the human experience of solitary confinement. Here's how the experiment works. They take a whole bunch of baby mice and raise them in a fun social environment, complete with toys and other baby mice to play with. Then, once they reach adulthood, a portion of the mice, the experimental group, are removed to an isolated tank. The rest of them stay in their little mouse community. They're the control group. After a period of 1 to 3 months, mice from both groups are euthanized and their brains compared under the microscope. Richard and one of his students gave me a look at the slides at his lab in Philadelphia.
So what are we looking at right now?
So this one is a neuron in layer 5 of the motor cortex.
That's Richard's PhD student, Vibal Hung. He's sitting in front of a computer screen, tracing a blown-up version of a single neuron.
So, and you can see here, we can 3D. Rotate it in 3D,
wow.
And that's how we can see all the different processes as you go through, and he can zoom in and out.
So how long will this analysis take?
Probably 2 a day or 3 a day.
And how many are you doing?
Yeah.
So if we have 5 regions of the brain, he has to analyze 500 cells to get one ant. And that's just for one time point.
It's painstaking work. But by the fall of 2018, they finished their analyses and were ready to present it. Which leads us back to that big Society for Neuroscience meeting. It was there in this room, packed with 250-plus people, that Richard got up and revealed what they had found.
Which was that in the sensory and motor parts of the cortex of the mouse, 1 month of isolation caused the neurons to shrink by about 20%.
Neurons are basically the building blocks of the brain, and communication between them is how our brains and nervous system function.
So if a cell is smaller, it has less possibilities of interacting with its neighbors.
Which in turn could make brain function worse. More to the point, Richard says it's a real physical defect that's been caused by the isolation.
If we put someone into prison and we took off 20% of their arm and said that's just a natural consequence of you having to be there, people would be outraged and say, you can't do that, that's torture. But if we are putting people into this situation and their neurons, these, which is a structural part of the brain, are shrinking 20%, you can't see that from the outside.
And even though this was mouse research and the findings are preliminary, it was an argument that won over the crowd at the conference. Michael says at the end, they got a standing ovation from the crowd.
It was really incredible. And it was very clear that we had literally touched a nerve in people who saw that the kind of work that we were doing and that they could, in principle, be doing as well, had some immediate social implications. This was not simply theoretical work. This is something that could affect humans today.
What is theoretical is how it'll play out as part of a larger legal argument against solitary confinement. For now, the courts don't accept animal research as evidence for effects on humans, but Michael and Richard are hoping that'll change.
Liz Tang reported that story. So we've heard from researchers, we've heard from former inmates, and we've heard from activists who are opposed to isolation, but many prison officials say they need solitary confinement and isolation cells to keep staff and inmates safe in often violent prison settings. And they say it's an effective way to discipline prisoners. Shirley Moore Smeal is the Executive Deputy Secretary for the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. In her more than 30 years in the department, she has seen a shift to move away from solitary confinement, but she says it remains a fundamental part of the correctional system.
I do believe that it's a necessary part of being in prison. I believe that to say that restrictive housing is not needed in prisons is the same as saying that, you know, correctional facilities are not needed in society. There's always going to be a need to confine some people at a higher degree than others, and that's for the greater good of everybody, for the safety and security of everybody. So I can see a reduction in the use. There's definitely a movement towards that, but total elimination, I'm not so sure that's where we would get to anytime soon.
That's Shirley Moore Smeal from the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. And these conversations about the use of solitary confinement are happening all over the country. Many states are reducing the use of solitary confinement or considering it, especially among juvenile inmates or inmates with mental health issues. We're talking about the impact of loneliness. So far, we've been hearing about isolation in prison, but now let's turn to feeling lonely or isolated at home, in your relationship, in your life.
You want the stuff on your feet? You want to put that lotion on?
Pat and Ted Davis have been married for more than 50 years. But recently, an illness has changed Ted, and now Pat finds herself in a marriage she doesn't recognize. Martine Chaussard has their story.
Pat Davis is preparing breakfast for her husband, Ted. Normally, by the time they sit down to eat, the newspaper has come. It gives them something to talk about. But today, the paper's late.
Let's see. Well, we can talk about the grandchildren. But even that, there's not much that holds his interest anymore, not much he wants to talk about. He was always a quiet person, but at least you could engage him in conversation. Now it's almost like you're still alone when you're with him. Do you remember when we started dating?
Seniors.
Yes, seniors in high school.
You're a senior.
That's right. We were.
Pat and Ted have been married for 53 years now. They raised three children, made it through thick and thin. But after Ted retired, their relationship changed. Actually, Pat says Ted changed.
I could see this look on his face. He'd be someplace far away, and he would be so sad looking. It was just, it just made me feel so horrible and so helpless to do anything for him.
Later on, Pat noticed something else about Ted's behavior. It wasn't just his mood.
I would come home, and doors would be left open in the wintertime, outdoors, you know, and he would not realize that he had left a door open.
One day, he showed up at the hospital, where Pat was a medical librarian.
And he said, "Why aren't you home?" And I said, "No, I'm not supposed to be home yet." And he said, "Yes, you are." And that really upset him, and that really upset me. So that was sort of like the defining thing.
Pat realized the problem was much bigger than simple forgetfulness. They saw psychiatrists and psychopharmacologists, and it took time to diagnose Ted. But all the changes Pat had observed, they were early signs of dementia.
Everything is new to him. Everything you tell him is new. You know, you ask me what can get me down. Oh, my God, when you're saying the same thing 10 times in less than 20 minutes, and it's like, oh, what day is it? What time is it? What are we doing today?
Dementia has now settled in with Pat and Ted for good. It lives in their house. It's right there on the tablet showing the day of the week and time of day to keep Ted oriented. When Pat leaves the house, she writes notes to Ted so he knows where she's gone. Ted can still walk the dog by himself. He just might do it multiple times in a row because he forgets he's already done it. It's been over 10 years since the signs of dementia showed up in their lives. But once in a while, the old Ted is still present and clever, like with his puns.
Oh, like yesterday. I said, "Oh, would you help me put this bracelet on?" He took the bracelet and put it on the top of my hand. He said, "Well, you said put it on." I said, "Oh, jeez."
Pat says becoming a caregiver has been a series of adjustments, not just in their home, but in their marriage, too.
I'm the cultural director. I'm the chauffeur. I'm the chef. I get to do it all.
And the person suddenly goes from not only taking care of whatever their regular demands were, but now they have to make all the decisions for someone else.
Psychologist Donna Jackson runs programs for families dealing with dementia in Falmouth, Massachusetts, where Pat and Ted live.
Part of the reason I got into the work over time, what I heard is that people just weren't enjoying themselves anymore. They weren't getting out into their community. But there are real reasons why people don't go out. There's stigma. Their loved one may become more anxious if the environment is too loud or too stimulating, or there are too many demands on them.
Pat does her best to maintain her social life. She volunteers at her church and at the public library. And twice a month, Pat and Ted go to the local senior center together. Ted meets with other dementia patients for a facilitated group discussion. Meanwhile, Pat heads to the caregiver support group.
I'm sorry?
Biggest group we've had.
At first, Pat says she felt out of place. She didn't think she needed outside help. But now, she has friends here. They understand how much a marriage has to change.
We try to help each other with workarounds, and those are probably called fiblets.
They talk a lot about phiblets, strategies that don't harm but can keep Ted calm and safe, like that day he wanted to drive his truck.
I'd say to him, would you let me drive the truck? He said, why? I said, I don't drive stick shift anymore, and I have to keep up my skills. Well, that wasn't true.
Ted ended up letting her drive the truck. But for caregivers, it can be hard to get used to the white lies. For years, they'd been in marriages with norms and rules they developed together as a couple. Now, the caregivers are on their own.
People grieve and deal with trauma best in a community.
That's psychologist Donna Jackson again.
You see that when people go through, you know, natural disasters and war, they heal better when they have naturalistic community supports.
And that is what might still be missing for many caregivers, the ability to socialize normally in ways that feel more natural than support groups. Because at the end of the day, for Pat, the words are still few and far between.
It's just like dragging words out of him, and it's just easier. One of the things I've done is instead of our eating dinner at the dinner table, I'll put up TV tables and we'll watch the news. But it would be nice to be able to have a conversation with somebody. So sometimes I feel like I'm a motor mouth, like right now, because I just, somebody's willing to listen. Someone's willing to have a conversation with me.
Loneliness still finds its way into the smallest nooks and crevices left by silence, even when you've had a full day, even when you're keeping busy.
I feel alone because I'm thinking, you know, I'm here with somebody else and it's like being alone, you know, and especially now he goes to bed 7 or 8 at night.
Every night after they eat dinner in front of the TV, Pat helps her husband get ready for bed.
Sometimes I'm not sure it's loneliness I feel. It's like, where did all the years go? Now we're at a point where it's not going to get better. It's just only going to keep going down. You know, like, how much more do I want to know I've got here? You know, do I want to know how much time is left? I've lived 2/3 of my life if I live to be 100. So the best is behind me? Or is there going to be anything in the future?
That story was reported by Martine Chaussard. Sometimes isolation is imposed by an illness. A sick person has to be kept away from other people to avoid infections or contagion. In 2015, Kate O'Brien had a cough she just couldn't shake. She was feeling awful, and then she started to cough up blood. She was also pregnant at the time, and she had a toddler at home. So she was exhausted. Test after test revealed nothing, and she was losing weight. But Kate and her doctor were reluctant to do a chest x-ray.
My concern was always the baby, the baby, the baby.
Eventually, her symptoms got so bad, she ended up in the hospital, and it turns out she had tuberculosis, a contagious lung disease. Suddenly, doctors and nurses were rushing around wearing masks and gloves, and they told Kate she had to move into a different area of the hospital, away from everybody.
They use the term isolation more than quarantine, but quarantine is exactly what it is. I knew that tuberculosis was infectious. I knew that this was like a disease that was airborne. They moved me into this room in the middle of the ICU that was like all glass, 2 sets of doors. I could not see the hallway. I could not see other people. Like, it felt like a jail cell. It's like cha-chunk, cha-chunk. I felt really removed because it was removed. My very air that I was breathing was being taken out a different way than everybody else's air, you know? Oh my gosh, it was so boring. So the problem wasn't really that feeling of the walls closing in and having to stay in bed, because I wanted to stay in bed anyway. It was really crushing loneliness. Like, that was the hardest part. I'm sure there's introverts out there that might have been okay with that, but I am not one of them. I love people. People, people, people. Like, I love them. But one thing, too, that was kind of heartbreaking and hard for me was watching the ER doctors and staff just come in the morning and take off their coats and take off their gloves, and take off their hats, and they had coffee with them, and they were just talking to each other. And I wanted that so bad. I just wanted to complain about the weather. And I just wanted to, like, high-five someone and touch someone and have a camaraderie about a shared experience instead of this experience where I was, nobody knew what it was like, and I was so totally alone.
Kate did have visitors, but only the people closest to her, and they had to wear masks.
My husband and my parents were saints throughout this process and came to visit me constantly. My sisters came to visit me constantly. But I didn't see my son for the entire treatment, from January to April. I went in when he was about like 2.5, and that was, it was terrible. It was terribly, terribly hard. I didn't feel right about him coming in to visit me. I just looked so terrible. I looked like a giant spider. Like, my arms and legs were so skinny and thin, and I had cords going all through my body, and my belly was this huge abdomen. I didn't want him seeing me like that. That was an amazing day, the day that I was no longer contagious. Everybody came in the room without masks on. They opened both doors. It was like a movie, and I could cry just telling you guys about it. I heard so much noise. It was so much louder just hearing the hallway, and just seeing everybody's chin was like just amazing. And I just kept crying. The more people came in, everybody was more beautiful than the next. A whole season changed when I was in the hospital. I went in January and I came out in April. The day I got to leave, it was beautiful out. It was spring. My son was in the lobby waiting for me, and it was just amazing. He was right there, and I was so worried he was my son wasn't going to recognize me or something. I don't know. I had some weird. I told my dad and my husband not to take pictures or video when he was there because I was afraid it wouldn't be a nice reaction and I would cry and I wouldn't want a video of it. But they know me and they didn't listen to me, and so we have a video of him just like running up to me.
I love you. I missed you. I missed you so much. Mommy's all better.
And I look at it all the time.
It's so big. What's Gammy doing?
A few weeks after Kate O'Brien was released, she gave birth to her second child, a healthy baby boy, in the same hospital where she was quarantined. Jen Kinney produced her story. Historically, medical quarantine has also been used on a broad scale as a preemptive measure to keep entire communities safe. History professor Alan Crowd says this practice came into being long before people really understood how illnesses spread or knew anything about germs and viruses.
One of the things that people thought they observed was that when individuals came from other parts of the world and were returning after a trip, that illness often came with them. And so speculation began that you really had to do something in order to protect a community from what might be coming from other places.
Alan teaches at American University in Washington, D.C. He says the practice of quarantining people started during the times of the Black Death, the plague, which wiped out about a third of the European population.
Well, the idea was you separated those who were returning from the native-born population for a period of time. You kept people separated for 40 days in Italian quarantina in the hopes that they would not show symptoms of illness. And if they didn't show those symptoms, you could admit them to the community.
So if you weren't dead or really sick after 40 days, you were okay.
You were judged okay. That's right.
Over the course of history, quarantine has also been a way to single out certain people or to blame them for outbreaks. Give me some examples of that.
So, for example, in the 1830s, there's a cholera epidemic that sweeps across the east coast of the United States. The Irish are blamed for that. In 1916, there's a polio epidemic. Italian immigrants are named the cause of that. Tuberculosis is regularly called either the Taylor's disease or the Jewish disease. And so one of the ways of expressing a nativist perspective is to marshal a scientific or medical explanation for why folks shouldn't be admitted to your community.
What are some other examples? I'm thinking, for example, about the way Canada quarantined people in response to SARS in 2003, or how some countries reacted to the AIDS epidemic.
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the things that happened in the course of the AIDS epidemic is that there was an effort to quarantine individuals. Some Haitians, they were quarantined at Guantanamo Bay to prevent them from coming to the United States because the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta classified Haitians as a high-risk group for HIV/AIDS. And that high-risk categorization was rescinded in 1995, but not before there was a tremendous amount of stigmatization and bad treatment of the Haitians in general. Quarantine was one of the instruments that were used because individuals were being stigmatized for those diseases, whether or not there was evidence that they had contracted any diseases.
Alan Crowd is a professor of history at American University in Washington, D.C. You're listening to The Pulse. We've been talking about loneliness and how the lack of social contact affects us. Imagine you're on another planet, slowly climbing up the side of a mountain for years, with nothing but dust and rocks for company. That's what life is like for one robot. Its name is Curiosity, and it's one of the robots with wheels that NASA calls rovers. This is a lonely rover, not the lost rover we've heard so much about recently. Alan Yu brings us this story of Curiosity and its human fans.
1 year after Curiosity arrived on Mars, the team at NASA marked the occasion by having the rover play a song.
I didn't think that people would pay attention to it.
That was Florence Tan, a deputy chief technologist at NASA. She came up with the idea, but it wasn't quite received like the team thought.
People were talking about poor rover. Is anyone else crying? That's the saddest birthday song I ever heard.
The YouTube video got more than 1.2 million views, and this is how lots of the commenters felt.
Happy birthday to me, happy birthday to me, I'm so very lonely, happy birthday to me.
That's Ashwin Vasavada, the project scientist for Curiosity. I asked him to read some of the reactions.
That's so depressing. It's singing to itself and can only hear the music echoing through the empty Martian landscape.
And then there was this one.
It's literally an inanimate object. Why am I still crying?
Ashwin says he kind of gets where people are coming from.
It's got to be pretty lonely where Curiosity is in this vast crater with absolutely nothing except the, you know, the sound of the wind and dust blowing around.
That's a recording of Martian wind. NASA changed it a little to make it audible. Sure, it's desolate on Mars, but Ashwin says we shouldn't be too worried. The humans at NASA stay in touch with Curiosity.
We say hi to it every morning and give it some productive things to do. So it's got some friends, but they're just not, you know, directly around it.
Technologist Florence Tan says she does have an emotional reaction when she sees Curiosity. But for her, that emotion is pride.
When I look at Curiosity, I look at it as, you know, I put that on Mars, you know, I did that. And it's great. And we're getting great science. And it's also encouraging the next group of young people to be excited, right? It's giving people a sense of, I could do this too.
There's an interesting backstory to how the rover came to play a song. And even that is really about the robot's core function of doing science. Curiosity studies what chemicals are on Mars. The rover scoops up a little bit of Martian dirt, burns it to vapor, then sends the vapor to various sensors inside it. That's how we found out Mars has some ancient chemical ingredients for life, like nitrogen and carbon. The team prepared for all sorts of problems, like what if the Martian dirt clogs a pipe? To avoid that, scientists programmed the robot so the containers holding the dirt shake. That way, the dirt doesn't get stuck. Software developer Tom Nolan had to test the shaker by having it vibrate. And for a little extra fun, he had it not just vibrate, but vibrate rhythmically.
It's doing what the shaker was designed to do, but doing it in a kind of an unexpected way.
Tom is Florence's husband, and they made it play Twinkle Twinkle Little Star and Beethoven's Fur Elise as a test in their lab.
Everybody was just bent over laughing. They thought this was the most hilarious thing, a piece of spaceflight hardware that was playing a little song. I guess it's engineer humor.
And that's how Curiosity was able to play a birthday song to itself. Planetary scientist Tanya Harrison says people may have had a strong reaction to that lonely song because rovers have eyes and arms.
You can think of it as something that is alive in some way, and it's acting as this emissary for us as humans on Mars since we can't get there ourselves just yet.
She worked on the previous Mars rover for NASA, and she says an emotional connection can be good. Last year, when the Mars rover Opportunity lost contact with Earth, the public rallied behind the little rover to get NASA to save it.
A lot of effort for NASA in terms of funding and what they decide to do really hinges on what the public is interested in and engaged in.
And last week, she was there when NASA made one last effort to try and get in touch with Opportunity.
Everybody went silent and just waited and watched this little screen where you would see a blip come up if we had heard something from the rover, kind of like, you know, watching for a heartbeat on a heart monitor or something like that. It didn't come.
The last message Opportunity sent back was cold, hard data on telemetry and power readings. But the general public embraced a different interpretation. My battery is low and it's getting dark.
The fact that people took that and tried to turn it into something very poetic coming from this machine on another planet, I think shows how much we're emoting with it and we're, you know, embodying it with emotions.
NASA, the European Space Agency, and China are all planning to send new rovers to Mars. Curiosity might not be all alone on the red planet for much longer.
Alan Yu reported that story. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Julian Harris is our intern. We had help producing this week's show from Jen Kinney. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.